From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the fallout from a spill of microplastics into the Kalamazoo River.
It's definitely not supposed to be eaten, and it's definitely not supposed to be, you know, released into the environment, because when these plastic pellets get into the water, they are very commonly mistaken for food by fish or birds.
Then we visit a nail salon in Detroit, marrying fashion and art at the tips of your fingers.
At the end of the day, if you're commissioning a piece by a sculptor, you're commissioning an artwork, and you are now a collector, and so why wouldn't we consider that here?
And a study from the University of Michigan looks at the impact of noise on wildlife.
Noise is, I think, one of those, if we want to call it a threat or, you know, an impact to species that is sort of understudied.
Those stories and more coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, a West Michigander shares a story about a congressional debate that took a sharp left turn.
So I said, let me get this out of the way. Yes, I went to college in the late 70s. Yes, I inhaled.
That's coming up on the show. But first, it's always distressing to see a semi overturned on the highway. But back in January, a wreck not too far from Saugatuck embodied an environmental problem that poses particular dangers and challenges that go way beyond the occasional hazard of a slippery road. This particular truck was loaded with little white plastic pellets that, when spilled, scattered all across I-96 and into the Kalamazoo River. The driver in this case, thankfully, was not injured. But these little pellets are part of a class of plastics that are showing up in disturbing levels in Michigan's water. Garrett Ellison reports for MLive. He covered both this incident and our larger problem. Garrett, thank you for stopping in.
Always. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about where this truck was? I gather we don't really know exactly where it was headed.
Yeah, we have no information on the origin point or the destination for this truck yet, but we do know that it crashed on the side of I-196 northbound, just as the truck was approaching the Kalamazoo River. That was on January 27th, which was a pretty treacherous day for travel in West Michigan. It was basically a blizzard. Whiteout conditions. There were, you know, crashes all up and down the highway that day. And unfortunately, what it sounds like was a 2024 Freightliner from Questliner in Iowa, as was the carrier, dumped on the side of the highway and spilled part of its load, which was polystyrene plastic pellets, also known as nurdles.
Can you give us a sense what these kind of pellets might be used for? I mean, we're not talking about packing peanuts here, right?
Yeah, this stuff is feedstock that goes into the production of plastic products, basically. So, it's very tiny grains of plastic, basically, about the size of a piece of cooked rice. And, you know, they get transported in large tanker trucks that essentially have conical shapes at the bottom of them, and they will, you know, roll over a container of some sort at their destination at the factory or whatnot, and, you know, just drop their load into that, much like you might see grains or other commodities.
And just to be clear, like, although they are referred to as feedstock, that's a term of industry, right? These are not supposed to be eaten.
Yeah. It's definitely not supposed to be eaten, and it's definitely not supposed to be, you know, released into the environment, because when these plastic pellets get into the water, they are very commonly mistaken for food by fish or birds.
Right. So this wreck, as we mentioned, happened toward the end of January on one of those really rough weather days when we had a lot of multi-car pileups. And yet, I understand from your research that this didn't get reported in as a pollution spill until much later, like in February. Do we know what took so long for the reporting to happen?
Yeah, we don't yet. What's been told to us is that the semi wrecked on January 27th, and then, you know, it spilled all these white plastic pellets in the middle of a snowstorm. And so the extent of the spill was not particularly clear at the time. It sounds like, according to local first responders, there was some level of cleanup attempted early on, But it was not disclosed to the public until last week on Wednesday evening. The Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy sent out a news release saying that this crash happened and that the spill took place, that some of the pellets had gotten into the Kalamazoo River because this, you know, the spill is right there at the one end of this bridge over the river. And, you know, that it was going to be cleaned up the next day. So MDOT, Michigan Department of Transportation, went out there on Thursday, February 27th, and they presumably cleaned that all up. Haven't verified that yet with the agencies, but that was the plan. We don't know exactly why it took a month, essentially, to release this information. Michigan Eagle says that they were only notified about this on February 19th. So, you know, more to come. There's questions here about, like, why it took so long to release this information.
Garrett, is there any way of knowing how much actually got into the river and might have gone downstream?
You know, I have not seen any sort of official estimate. When I visited the site last week on Thursday, it's obvious that some has gotten into the river because you can see plastic pellets in the water. It did not appear to be like there was a staggeringly large amount of plastic pellets in the water. Most of what I saw was still in a large pile on the side of the highway that, because it's white, most people driving by it probably wouldn't give it a second look. It just looks like a big snowdrift that hasn't melted.
Right.
But there's definitely a trail from this huge pile of plastic down the embankment through a stand of Phragmites onto the, you know, sand below the bridge and into the river. I took pictures of pellets in the water. In terms of how much entered the river, that's really hard to say.
Sure. So, Garrett, let's talk a little bit about the big picture. I mean, one spill from one truck, obviously it's not great. But can you tell us a little bit more about what biologists say about microplastics like this and their concerns about these materials?
Microplastics are definitely what's being considered sort of a contaminant of emerging concern, right? Which means that there's a lot more study that needs to be done and is being done about what happens to them once they're in the environment, what the, you know, ecological and public health, you know, hazard component is. Microplastics of various types and sizes have been found in all kinds of places that they shouldn't be, including, you know, blood samples, drinking water, environmental samples in far-flung regions where you wouldn't expect there to be plastic samples. And in the Great Lakes, they're definitely, you know, in the water. And we're talking stuff that is sort of like nano-level plastics, as well as, you know, smaller plastic pieces that are, you know, visible but tiny. Just look at if you go to the beach, just look at the shoreline, look at what's being washing up on the shore. And these types of plastic pellets are definitely something that you will find on the shorelines, particularly around the mouths of rivers.
Wow. You quoted this one study that was really kind of wild. Back in 2018, there was research done at the University of Western Ontario that looked at 66 beaches all around the Great Lakes states and found these nurdle pellets with a variety of colors, an average of 19 pellets per square meter. That was pretty eye-opening for me. The state has been doing some research and has funded a little bit more effort on Eagle's part into microplastics. Can you tell us what's going on with that right now?
Right now, the state of Michigan is sampling rivers and streams for microplastics. They started doing that last year using a one-time $2 million appropriation. My understanding is that data is still sort of being quality checked and analyzed. But when I checked in with the state, Michigan Eagle last summer, they, you know, said the early results show that microplastics are pretty widespread throughout Michigan waters.
Yeah. Is there any sense among conservationists or folks who do work around remediation about if we wanted to get a hold on this problem, where would we start?
Well, every time you talk to, you know, folks in the academic or conservation realm, what they say is that the solution is sort of at the producer level, requiring plastic manufacturers to take responsibility for plastic waste through some sort of tightened rules around responsibility for plastic throughout its life cycle, that's really the ultimate solution because, similar to just about any other type of contaminant or pollutant, once it's out in the environment, you're dealing with the problem at the wrong end of it. You're dealing with the cleanup, it's expensive, and the better way to handle it is to prevent it from getting into the environment in the first place.
I mean, truck spills don't happen every single day. What else can you tell us about how nurdles get into the ecosystem?
Well, it's not really well known exactly. Like from what I understand, there are spills that are documented and disclosed periodically, but a spill like this on the highway is like the first time I've seen it. Which was really sort of surprising to me when I talked to a local fire chief who responded to this spill, and when I was interviewing him, he said, "Oh yeah, I've seen this before." And it sounds like a couple of times throughout his career, he's seen big tanker trucks like this wreck on the highway, spill their pellets. That results in a cleanup, but there's probably no way that those efforts to dig that stuff out of the side of the highway catch everything, right? And so it's interesting to me to hear that, and it sort of suggests to me that highway spills from tanker trucks might be a vector for this stuff to a greater degree than we've realized. But that, there's some more reporting that needs to be done on that.
Garrett Ellison reports for MLive. You can find his story about the Nurdle spill that underscores a pretty big threat within the Great Lakes at MLive.com. Garrett, thank you so much.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
With the U.S. and Israel conducting military attacks in Iran today, we just wanted to take a moment to say that we know there are people here in Michigan watching and worrying, especially those with family or loved ones living in the region or possibly serving in the military. If this moment is affecting you, we'd like very much to hear from you. You can call us and leave us a message. The number is 734-764-7840. That's 734-764-7840. Or you can also email us. Our address is stateside@michiganpublic.org. It's time for us to take a break now. When we come back, redefining nail art and why it's not just a salon service.
This is art. We see nails as ephemeral sculpture or as temporary sculptures on your nails.
You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Not everyone goes for regular manicures, but if you do, there's been a lot of development in the space in recent years. Gel nail products have made it possible for nail artists to really push the boundaries, creating art that pops off the nail bed in three dimensions. Imagine a manicure with tiny flowers, pieces of fruit, or little objects like billiard balls resting gracefully on a curated palette of colors. Cynthia Robinson is the owner of a Detroit business that is redefining the manicure. Her studio is called Cure Nail House. She's encouraging us and the artists that she employs to put creativity in the driver's seat, in doing so, plugging into a tradition of nail art in Black fashion. We went to visit Cure recently to talk to Robinson about her work. Thank you for having us down here. This space is beautiful.
Thank you.
Can you maybe tell us about, where the whole journey with nail art began for you?
Yeah, so my journey with nail art really began, I would say, when I was about 4 years old, sitting in my mom's lap, getting my nails done with her. I watched her constantly doing it, and I was always on my mom's lap or hanging on to her. We're twins, and, that's my girl, okay? It's her birthday today, so shout out to her. But, yeah, honestly, it all started when I was just a little baby.
I think we all look at our moms as a paragon of style and glamour. How would you describe your mom's style?
My mom's style is very eclectic, very much her, right? My mom is such a... She loves fashion. She loves to show up. She loves to express herself. She loves to play with color. She loves to, just be fly. My mom's style is fly. She's a fly girl always through and through. And so, you know, that's what I grew up watching and seeing and, you know, ultimately what inspired me.
I know as a young person, you were away from Detroit for a while. Can you maybe tell us how you started settling on the idea of nail art that became Cure?
Yeah, so it all started really when I moved back to the city. So like you said, I moved from Detroit at around, you know, 12, 13 years old to the suburbs in Birmingham, Michigan, and then went to undergrad. And when I went to grad school, I moved back to the city at Wayne State. And it was kind of like me coming back to myself, my culture, my roots. And I recognized that I just wasn't seeing the things that I grew up, you know, experiencing, right? You know, there were nail salons in the city. Sure, there were nice nail salons, but there weren't salons that really allowed for the type of work and nail artistry that I grew up seeing. And for me, that just was something that really inspired me to say, you know what, this belongs here. This is something that I used to see in these same areas, and I'm not seeing that anymore. So I wanted to change it.
I think it sounds like what we're talking about here is a space that is welcoming to, you know, Black art and Black creativity. Can you talk about some of the values that you really wanted baked in here to make sure that this was that kind of space?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's one aspect of seeing someone like me, you know, running and owning a space, but there's another thing entirely when you see people, Black women in this space that are doing work like this in this type of setting, right? Normally, they're kind of siloed or, you know, they're just not usually a lot of spaces that are like mine that create this type of work. I think for the community, it definitely piques everyone's interest to be able to have really great work done at such a scale and level in this type of, you know, dynamic and demographic. But ultimately, you know, this space is for all women, you know. It's owned by a Black woman, and it's certainly inspired by Black women. And I think you'll see that when you're here. But in terms of our values, you know, we're big on inclusivity. We want everyone to feel seen, understood, heard, and feeling like they can express themselves. We want them to be able to come in this space and feel comfortable partnering, conversing, you know, with, you know, the artists that we have here and being able to come out with something that's absolutely beautiful and that represents who they are. We see nails here as an artistic practice, as a ritual. And so, you know, a big part of the experience is ultimately just uplifting that, you know, for everyone.
Looking at all the materials and your social feeds, I noticed that Cure is not a nail salon. It is a nail studio. Mm. Can you say more about what that designation carries for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, when you hear nail salon, you think of the commercialized context of a space that is centered around, you know, just care work and just, you know, very much going in and out and being treated like a number and not a person, right? And I can't say that's for all places, but I think that's for a lot of places in general. And that comes with a certain stigma and expectation. I think for us, kind of deviating from that, it ultimately means that, you know, we're a space that really does take care of, you know, our guests, our collectors, right? You know, we're really big on taking our time with the work that we're doing. We're not in a rush. You know, we're here to make sure we're doing great work and connecting and building with you to help you create something as well, because this is a collaboration at the end of the day, right? And ultimately, yeah, I mean, we're experimenting. You know, there are times when it's like, hey, I don't know how I'm gonna do this, but let's figure it out together and let's make something happen and let's have fun while we do it, right? It's a space that, you know, for us comes, there's so much more that comes out of this space outside of nails. But yes, this is the primary aspect of, you know, what we're about. But more than anything, we're about community. And the studio is, you know, where artists are here in practice as artists, ultimately.
You just referred to people who are coming in to get their nails done as collectors. I must hear more about this. Why have you started using that word?
Well, we've always really used that word because this is art. You know, we see nails as ephemeral sculpture or as temporary sculptures on your nails, right? And so these extensions, these mediums, you know, that we're using to build on your nail are the same mediums that other, you know, artists that are, you know, painters and sculptors are using to create, you know, really amazing works that are more long lasting. And so for us, you know, at the end of the day, if you're commissioning a piece by a sculptor, you're commissioning an artwork and you are now a collector. And so why wouldn't you be considered that here, right? Granted, it's a temporary installment, but it's still art and still sculpture. And so it's just on a different, you know, canvas, which would be nails. And so, yes, that is why we say collectors here.
When did you, as an artist, start thinking about the work of nails in more of a context of a 2D or 3D sculpture rather than a consumer service?
Yeah. So honestly, I've really been toying with the idea and just digging deeper over the years throughout this process. I mean, let's keep in mind, I've been building this for 8 years. And so along the way, you know, around my journey, I converse with a lot of my friends who are also artists, and I'm just interrogating. I interrogate everything because that's just who I am. And, you know, I'm trying to understand ultimately why nails isn't positioned or seen as this, right? Is this in this way? And then I'm, you know, untraining my mind and retraining my mind to think about it entirely differently. And then now also trying to, you know, get the world to see it my way, right? And so it is a job, it's a journey, but I would say I probably started thinking about this, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and then continuing to build upon it, you know, as my research understanding, you know, expanded.
Let's talk a little bit more about the space where we are right now. I feel like it would take maybe a half a day to convert this into a high-end cocktail bar. There's a lot of, it's a beautiful space. I see a lot of jewel tones, and it has an overall vibe of calm and luxury. Can you describe where we are and maybe talk about designing the space?
Yeah, so right now we're in the studio. And what you really see is a lot of, you know, warm colors, like you mentioned, jewel tones. So you see the blues, you see the purple hues, you also see the maroons. And let's just be clear, I'm a Taurus, so I'm a moody girl. I love, love, love moody colors. That just makes me feel like someone's hugging me. I love comfort. And so these colors ultimately give me comfort. They make me feel good. They make me feel warm inside. And, you know, Cure is the inside of my mind. At the end of the day, it's my baby, right? And so I partnered with my best friend, who's also my design partner, Tiffany Thompson, to really bring this story and this feeling to life. And she was really, really excellent and just helping me pick the right colors, helping me to pick the right, you know, materials and elements. So you'll see a lot of that throughout the space, where you have mixed metals, lots of silver, you know, lots of gold. You also have stone. You have these different moments that are happening throughout the space, but they all tell a really cohesive story.
There is an array of framed portraits up on the wall, and it's all Black women. Can you tell us a little bit about who's up on the wall and how you selected them?
Yeah, so we've got Donna Summer, Madam C.J. Walker in her school, big, big inspiration to me. These are ultimately all women who paved the way in the nail industry and who have represented what we see in mainstream media today throughout the different, you know, years and decades, you know, before us. And so everyone knows about Madam C.J. Walker and her school and what she did for, you know, the hair industry. But she also had a cosmetology school that taught hair and nails. You also have amazing women like Diana Ross. And of course, how can I forget my mother, right? She's right here dead center.
That stunner in the black cocktail dress.
That's right. You see her, you know? And then you also have Flo Jo. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her story.
Oh yeah, Olympic runner Florence Griffith Joyner, who is well known for her nail style.
Exactly. Danielle Luna, and then last but not least, Aretha Franklin.
Nice. If you're just joining us, we're on site at Cure Nail House with founder Cyndia Robinson, talking about what she has brought to bear here in Detroit. You know, it's funny, looking at the picture of Florence Griffith Joyner, I remember that Olympics where she was first competitive for gold, and I remember how she just exploded into the public consciousness. I mean, I don't remember runners having a sense of style.
Yeah.
I mean, she was a big deal because she was a Black woman, you know, competing, but she was also a big deal because she was being 100% herself.
Yeah.
And she got a lot of flack for her nails.
Yeah, she did.
Were you like old enough to watch that Olympics and remember?
No, I wasn't old enough, but I definitely did my research and was so inspired and in awe of what she went through. Honestly, you know, she's a gold Olympic medalist, and all people can talk about are her ghetto nails. She caught a lot of flack for just being herself, and going against the grain of, you know, what is considered or deemed appropriate, but there's nothing inappropriate when it comes to how we express ourselves. I think she was very brave and ultimately was resisting the norm and staying true to herself. And I think that's something that my mom has also instilled in me and speaks to just how she shows up in her style as well. So
how many artists do you now have working here at Cure?
Right now we have 10 artists.
Wow. Who are they? Can you share a little bit about the kind of creative streak that you were looking for in staffing up?
You got to be fly. You got to have fun. You've got to be expressive. I don't want to work with people who want to stay in a box. I want to work with people who want to experiment, who want to play, who, you know, aren't afraid to try something new, because you're going to get that, right? You're going to get those people who challenge you to kind of, you know, take it there. And I want to know that you have the confidence to do it, right? And confidence, you know, is a muscle. You've got to build it for sure. But ultimately, just being able to take a step out of, you know, of what makes you so comfortable and just being able to just play. But more than anything, you know, the foundation of your work has to be, you know, really great. The personality, of course, has to be amazing, because we see so many different women and people that come in and they do want to pour their hearts out, right? And we want to have space for them. We're therapists too, right? And so with that, you know, just being able to show up not only for ourselves, but give them something to be inspired by too.
There's an education piece to what you're doing here. Can you talk about developing that and why it came to you that it should be a part of the work?
Yeah, so absolutely. Yeah, so the educational component craft is, you know, in the works. We do plan on launching it this summer. I'm really excited to say, but it ultimately is just an educational platform to teach nails as a fine art practice. So really what that means is you'll be able to come here and get your license as a nail artist, and we will be the ones to teach you. You know, of course, I'll be hiring educators that can, you know, really help to drive, you know, our curriculum. But we are absolutely following state guidelines, but then putting our spin on it as well and taking it a little bit further, because we just got our own style of how we like to do things, too. And really beyond that, go ahead.
Can I ask, like, what about your own experience informs that? Was there a certain kind of encouragement to innovate that was helpful to you when you were learning your trade?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, in a lot of, you know, cosmetology programs, you know, and I've only been through one, right? I can't speak to all of them, but from what I've gotten a consensus of, even from the girls that have come here, you know, is that they learn certain things, but they don't learn certain things. And, you know, in a way, some ways, you know, they come here wanting to learn more and experiment and play with more. I think, you know, our requirements might be a little dated, and I think I want to take us into the modern. And so, you know, when I say I'm going beyond just what the state requires, it just means that, you know, you won't come out learning the basics. You're going to actually know how to do much more than that, and be prepared for whatever, you know, this city or this world has to give you when it comes to the nail industry and expectations.
I've got to believe that Detroit is a tough market. I mean, there are a lot of artists out there, and there's a lot of people doing for themselves, even if they're not working in a salon. I mean, you've got to be competitive, right?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think a big part of that is, you know, skill. People are able to sustain, you know, on their own because they are really greatly skilled, and that's awesome. But then what about those people that are in salon, you know, spaces? Sometimes they only know how to do certain things. And for us, we really kind of are, a lot of us are jack of all the different mediums, or jack of all trades, but in the different mediums, right? And so you won't get pigeonholed into only being able to see one person for one thing. We do have really great artists here.
Cyndia, in getting this off the ground, you've had to move into a little different role where you're not in the creative space as much. You're running the business.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you still get to express yourself creatively?
I do, because I really have a lot of fun with the marketing. So that's actually my background. That's what I went to school for, especially with my bachelor's degree. I got my bachelor's in journalism, and I minored in PR and communication at Oakley University. And so I love visual storytelling. That's always kind of been my thing. That's really what I was doing all these years leading up to opening the space, and also practicing nails too. But my main thing was visual storytelling. So I still get to have fun with that. And I really do enjoy that. Of course, I love the nails. It's never going to, but I'm here every day. So I still get to see it. I get to enjoy it. I get to watch. And sometimes I might jump in a little bit.
Can you tell us about some looks that have been made here recently that have really caught your eye?
Yeah, well, I'm a girl that loves texture, so anything texture is automatically just gonna make me go, ooh, you know. I love chrome. I love, you know, just playing with the different powders to create some really cool iridescent moment. But the latest look that I could say that I really, really loved was like, it was a Valentine's Day theme set, and the works were just absolutely gorgeous. They took this amazing like pink chrome, and then they layered it over this textured gel that they used to manipulate into like a French manicure. And it was just gorgeous. I can't really say much more than that. You know, of course they had a couple really cool moments and adornments and things with stones and things as well. But for me, it was just that textured moment with the glossy, gorgeous poppy chrome that I just can't stop thinking about, honestly.
Thanks again to Cyndia Robinson, founder and artist at Cure Nail House in Detroit, for having us in. It was a lot of fun. We're going to take just a moment's pause now. After that, what is stressing Michigan's birds?
Noise is something that we, I think, have seen as sort of a nuisance in the past and maybe not something that has real impacts on species.
We'll be right back. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you've ever lived in a construction zone or along a busy bus route, you might have noticed wildlife seems just a little bit less active in those kinds of corridors. For good reason. Speeding cars and physical hazards would deter critters from making a plate across the street. But we now have some new research from the University of Michigan showing that noise pollution on its own hurts the ability of birds to reproduce and thrive. Here to talk through the findings with us is Natalie Madden, former grad student at the U of M School for Environment and Sustainability. She's also the lead author on this bird study. Hey, Natalie, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, April. Thanks for having me.
What got you interested in this subject, noise pollution, and the impact it has on our birds?
Yeah, I think so. This research actually started out as my master's project. And I really wanted to do research that was going to have an impact that could be used by biologists or, you know, wildlife managers, that they could take the information that we're using and implement it into real life scenarios. And we sort of landed on birds and noise because birds are really sensitive to acoustic information. They rely on acoustic information for, you know, a lot of different aspects of their life and for their survival. And noise is, I think, one of those, if we want to call it a threat or, you know, an impact to species that is sort of understudied. Like, we know that habitat loss has huge impacts on species, like destroying habitat and things like that. But noise is something that we, I think, have seen as sort of a nuisance in the past and maybe not something that has real impacts on species.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how you collected your research and the period of time that you were investigating?
Sure. Yeah. So we essentially did a giant literature search, and we looked at studies starting from 1990 all the way through 2025. We're looking for studies that specifically looked at the impacts of noise on birds. So like you said in your intro, you know, there's lots of different impacts that species might face, like, you know, cars driving by, actual machinery. But we really wanted to look at studies that separated those different aspects and specifically looked at noise.
There are many kinds of noise that I guess might be of interest here. What mm-hmm. types of noise did you consider to be disturbing enough to categorize them as noise pollution?
Yeah, so we kind of relied on the studies that we pulled data from, depending on how they categorize noise. And then when we looked at all those together, we further categorized them. So we looked at urban noise. So that included things like cars driving by, just sort of the general noise of having people around. It also included things like landscaping tools, like lawnmowers or leaf blowers. We also looked at aircraft noise. So obviously that is coming from, airports, helicopters, things like that. We looked at industrial noise. So that was things like gas compressors. It also included sort of like heavy machinery. And then some studies actually used manipulated noise within like controlled environments. So within a lab, they sort of would create noise, I guess. And so they used like brown noise or pink noise, and those we just sort of categorized as other.
Okay, what is brown noise and pink noise? I know all about white noise, but the other colors, I confess, I'm a little less familiar.
Yeah, so it's similar to white noise, but it's just at a different frequency.
Were there types of birds that seem most susceptible to noise pollution?
So we didn't look at specific species. We didn't break it down that way in our research. We just sort of looked at the categories of responses, and then we looked at traits. So we wanted to see if there were specific traits that made species more vulnerable to noise pollution.
And what was your conclusion about that?
So we did find some relationship between certain traits and certain responses. So for example, when we were looking at physiology, we found that the effects of noise on physiological responses were smaller for species that live in deciduous forests or grassland when we compared that to species that are considered generalists, so they can kind of live in lots of different types of environments. We also saw that there were greater changes in habitat use for birds who live in open nests compared to those who are in cavity nests, so like in trees, or they have, sort of an enclosed nest. We found lots of different things, but those are some of the big ones that we saw significant effects for.
Natalie, I mean, I think everybody hearing us right now is probably aware that noise pollution can really increase human stress quite a lot. Were you able to come to any conclusions about what's going on physiologically? Or I don't know if we would say this with respect to birds, but maybe psychologically with exposure to noise pollution?
Yeah, so I can say that our physiological response category included things like cortisone levels in, birds. They looked at, different aspects of blood composition. So we can say that there were changes in those hormones within the birds when they were exposed to noise.
Is there anything that you were able to suss out about how noise might have affected birds over generations?
Yeah, so it's hard to say like really long term. I think that's something that we should definitely look into as a future study. But when we look at our reproduction category of responses, that did include things like the number of eggs that are being laid, or the number of birds that parents are able to fledge to adulthood. So we are seeing a negative impact to those types of responses. What that means for populations over long term, it's hard to say right now, but I would suspect that there is some impact there from noise.
This feels like a disturbing bunch of findings. It also strikes me as something that might make for a heavy policy lift, reducing noise pollution for the sake of bird species. What comes up for you when you think about possible avenues that might be low-hanging fruit in cities, counties, states that might want to do something about noise pollution for bird species, or I guess for other species like humans as well?
Yeah, I mean, the World Health Organization has identified noise as, hazardous to people. So I think there's lots of reasons that we could work to reduce noise pollution. And I think, like you said, that there may be a lot of doom and gloom in this because there's a lot of negative findings. But I think the positive is that this is something that we can handle. And I think there's lots of different ways that we could do that. So, sort of on an individual level, we could think about using, electric vehicles or battery-powered landscaping tools. Obviously, not everyone has the means to go out and just like buy an electric vehicle and change that. But when it comes to policy and species management, we can really consider noise as, you know, a threat to species and something that needs to be managed. So we can think about improving technologies for things like, you know, heavy machinery. We could think about the timing for when we, you know, engage in development. So maybe we just avoid the breeding season for when we focus on development, because that's when species are really vulnerable to noise. Or we avoid areas where there's imperiled species who might be really impacted by noise. So I think there's, you know, different avenues and different levels for protecting birds and humans and other species from noise pollution.
Natalie Madden is a conservation scientist and policy analyst. She was lead author on this study at the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability. Natalie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have a follow-up for you today from our on-hand series, Your Stories from Around Michigan. Here's producer Mike Blank.
This is On Hand, a podcast answering your questions about the things that make Michigan unique. I'm Mike Blank. On our most recent episode of On Hand, we heard from Jacksonians about how their city should be recognized as the official birthplace of the anti-slavery Republican Party. We asked listeners for their Michigan political stories, and you did not disappoint.
Hi, my name's Kate Lennis, and I'm originally from Muskegon, Michigan. But when this particular political encounter happened, I was living in Grand Rapids. I ran for the 3rd District federal congressional seat in 2002. I was very active in the Kent County Democratic Party. And back then, it was very, very red, but we didn't want to be unrepresented. And so people would volunteer to run just so that the incumbent wouldn't be unopposed. And so I volunteered in 2002. To be honest, I have been a political junkie my entire life. I used to skip school to watch Watergate hearings. And so I was actually very enthusiastic about doing it. My opponent was Vern Ehlers. He actually won in a special election when Paul Henry died, and that's when he went into federal office. But he'd been a state senator and representative for a number of years, and he and I actually worked together on some underground storage tank legislation. For my day job, I was an environmental consultant, and I did permitting and cleanup work and stuff like that in Michigan and across the country. So I actually knew Vern quite well. I just got out and pounded the pavement, you know, met a lot of people. I got to tag along with then candidate Jennifer Granholm, and it was fun. I mean, I did the old fashioned way, knocking on the door kind of thing. I always carried good dog cookies with me, because when people are answering the door and they're kind of hesitant or wanting to shut the door in your face and you go, oh, what a cute dog. Can they at least have a cookie even if you don't want to talk to me? I got votes that way. Well, we had three different debates, but the one that I sent you the story about was at the Wealthy Theater in Easttown, and it was sponsored by WGVU and a couple of local high schools. I don't remember which ones now. It was great to hear what was on the mind of high schoolers. You know, they were not quite a voting age yet, but it was great to see how engaged they were. It was Vern's turn to answer first, and the last question was, and keep in mind, this is 2002, what do you think, what's your position on making medical marijuana legal? And Vern just went off. I mean, he was almost fire and brimstone about it. It's like, you know, I saw minds absolutely ruined when I was in Berkeley getting my doctorate in 68. And, you know, he just carried on about how awful it was. And then his last statement was, and if I had my way, I would ban alcohol again. And this gasps went through the audience. It just like rippled from the front to the back. And then I was next. And I'm sitting there, and I'm a lot younger than Vern. And this isn't all that long after Bill Clinton's famous quote, I tried marijuana, but I didn't inhale, right? And I knew they'd ask me about it because they knew what age I was. And so I said, let me get this out of the way. Yes, I went to college in the late 70s. Yes, I inhaled. And at that point, Byrne looked at me with this mixture of disgust and disappointment on his face. And I kind of looked out the corner of my eye at him, and then I answered the question. When it was all over and done with and the mics were shut off, I turned to him and I said, "What did you give me that look for?" And he says, "Well, I knew there had to be some reason you were so liberal." It was just that comment alone made running for office worth it, even though I knew I was going to lose. So it must have been about a year later, there was a state Democratic Party training session in East Lansing. And Al Gore was there. He was out of office by then. And Representative Conyers was there, John Conyers. And I was backstage with them, and I'm telling them this story. You know, watching Al Gore on the stump, he was so stiff and wooden appearing, particularly in things like debates. But I'd heard that he was really loose and funny and warm in person. And he laughed so hard when I got to the punchline of that story that I saw the guy that everybody said he really was. And I will treasure that. And Conyers thought I did a good Vern Ehlers imitation. I'm really glad that I ran. I don't think I'd do it now. I thought about it, but I don't think I will now. I haven't totally withdrawn. I just feel like there's too many people that are long in the tooth in politics. But I just got appointed to the City of Muskegon's Brownfield Redevelopment Authority. And, you know, to come full circle, growing up here when it was really polluted, sometimes the air would be crunchy. Ash would fall from the big gray metal foundry that was 2 miles from our house. And there wasn't even an EPA then. And when I was a little kid, I kept saying, I'm going to fix this when I grow up. And I spent 40 years doing that kind of thing. And so now I get to come back to my hometown when we're redeveloping the Muskegon waterfront and their contaminated sites. And so it's really cool for me. I'm looking forward to being able to contribute rather than, you know, like running for city council or something.
That's Kate Linus sharing her piece of Michigan political history. Thank you so much for sharing, Kate. We also want to mention a listener who posted on social media about an elder relative's relationship with President Gerald R. Ford. Quote, "My grandma went on a few dates with him in high school at South High. She always had a very high opinion of him as a man of good character, role model, and was not afraid to ask the hard questions and speak up, even when it was not popular." Unquote. And Paul Daniels of Indian River, Michigan, wrote us about an awkward interaction with President George W. Bush. Daniels was a contractor at the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan in 2006 when Bush visited. "I was very close and extremely thrilled to be standing this close to the most powerful man in the world. Unexpectedly, he walked straight up to me, grabbed my hand, and said, 'Thank you for serving your country in Afghanistan.' I was in such a state of shock that he somehow chose me out of a crowd of 1,000 people. I was stunned and downright speechless. All I could get out was, 'Thank you.' He looked at me for a second with a look that said, 'Gee, don't you want to talk for a minute?' And then he turned around and walked away. I was not ready for this handshake. If I could only live it over, I would have spoken to him for a little while." Paul, thank you so much for sharing. And many thanks to all the listeners who reached out about their Michigan political stories and interactions. Thanks for listening.
And before we let you go today, we want to play you a voice memo we got last week from listener Julie Goebel.
"Our family lived in Grand Rapids in the 1960s, and my mom worked as a waiter at Fingers Restaurant. And one day while she was working, who should come in the door but Congressman Gerald Ford? He was with a group of people and requested a private room. So my mom and a friend of hers waited on the group. When they were finished, Congressman Ford and Betty both thanked the waiters and left them a $100 bill as a tip, which was a very nice tip in the late 1960s. My mom's friend actually kept the spoon he ate off and said, 'One day, Congressman Ford will be president.' He came back to the restaurant with another group of people and asked that my mom and her friend again be their waiters. And I just thought that was such a lovely example of Midwestern nice. That's my story. Thanks.
Thanks for sharing that story, Julie. We'd love it if you would submit your stories and questions for On Hand. All you have to do is go to the Michigan Public website and find the On Hand page to post your reply. You can email us, too. The address is onhand@michiganpublic.org. That's all for Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. See you tomorrow.